Welcome to Honey from the Rock, a podcast devoted to Bible exposition. My father, Jack Christensen, preached expositionally for over 50 years, first as a missionary to Pakistan and later as a pastor in New England. His legacy lives on in me. He often began his sermons with a little expression, and now a little honey from the rock, taken from Psalm 81, verse 16. The psalmist wrote, "I would feed you with the finest of the wheat, and with honey from the rock I would satisfy you." Today, more than ever, we need to feed our souls on the words of God in the Bible. The crying need of the church is for God-centered, word-explaining messages. So now, my friends, a little honey from the rock. When Princess Diana died, the world mourned her life as a candle in the wind. This beautiful yet fragile woman, who did so much good for so many, was openly seeking peace for her tormented soul. Dodi took her to see a psychic. Time magazine reported that the psychic had once tried to put Diana in touch with her dead father. Princess Di had sought peace for her confused soul for years. She struggled with emotional disorders like bulimia and self-mutilation. She consulted astrologers and many psychotherapists over the years. She also tried various alternative healing methods such as aromatherapy, acupuncture, colonic irrigation, holistic massage, mud therapy, reflexology, and energy healing, to name just a few. Here was a woman searching for answers for her soul. The wealthy and the powerful have soul needs just like the poor and common people of this world. Daniel 2 is the story of a sleepless king tormented in his soul and how a young man of 18 is able to point him to God. Turn to Daniel chapter 2, verses 1 through 3. Now in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar had dreams, and his spirit was troubled, and his sleep left him. Then the king gave orders to call in the magicians, the conjurers, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans to tell the king his dreams. So they came in and stood before the king. The king said to them, "I had a dream, and my spirit is anxious to understand the dream." The first principle we learn here is that the pressures of our world present opportunities for our witness. The pressures of our world present opportunities for our witness. Daniel 2 has been described as a contest between God and the idols of Babylon, or between Daniel and the court magicians. King Nebuchadnezzar has disturbing dreams. The Hebrew is specific. The dreams are many, not one. Probably the same dream is repeated over and over again. The dream is so disturbing that the king cannot sleep. Literally, sleep was gone from him. Verse 1 tells us that his mind or spirit was troubled. Literally, the word for mind here is the word for breath, wind, or spirit. We could paraphrase the phrase and say that the dreams took his breath away. We know from verse 29 of this chapter that the dreams had to do with the future of his kingdom. So the king is concerned with the future of his kingdom. Verse 1 tells us that he experienced these dreams in the second year of his reign. How does this chronological indicator fit with Daniel 1, verse 5, in which Daniel and his three friends were to be educated for 3 years? One possibility is that the events at the end of chapter 1, where Daniel graduated from the school, occur after the events of chapter 2. This seems unlikely given the flow of events in chapter 2 and the fact that Daniel was included among the wise men to be executed. Furthermore, in verse 13, Daniel apparently lives outside the immediate court setting since they have to look for him in the city. There's a fairly simple explanation once we understand Babylonian record keeping. The first year would have been called the accession year, so the second year would have actually been considered the first year of the reign. The third year would have been the king's second year. Since they considered partial years to be full years in their accounting of regnal periods, Daniel probably had just graduated from his three-year program when these dreams began to trouble the king. I believe God has set Daniel up through the crisis he allows to develop around Daniel. God sends the dreams to get Nebuchadnezzar's attention. So the king gathers his top advisors to explain the dream to him. God often uses stress to get the attention of people so that they will listen to him. The pressures of our world present opportunities for our witness. Think of it this way. A troubled mind is an open mind. When people are struggling, confused, and hurting, it is time when they can become open to God at work in their lives. People rarely are open to God during the good times when everything is going well. It is during the bad times when they are open to God and what God has to say to them. These are the opportunities we have for witnessing. Rick Warren, in his book The Purpose-Driven Church, writes, "Who are the most receptive people? I believe there are two broad categories, people in transition and people under tension. God uses both change and pain to get people's attention and make them receptive to the gospel." The leadership of Saddleback Church did a study and found the 10 most receptive groups of people, and these are the ones they reach out to. 1, second-time visitors to the church. 2, close friends and relatives of new converts. 3, people going through a divorce. 4, those who feel their need for a recovery program from alcohol or drugs. 5, first-time parents. 6, the terminally ill and their families. 7, couples with major marriage problems. 8, parents with problem children. 9, recently unemployed or those with major financial problems. And 10, new residents in the community. Crisis. So God sets up a crisis. He introduces circumstances that will get people's attention and make them receptive to his message. In this case, troubling dreams lead to a crisis. Principle number 2. An impossible crisis challenges the limits of our human resources, verses 4 through 13. Then the Chaldean spoke to the king in Aramaic. "O king, live forever. Tell the dream to your servants, and we will declare the interpretation." The king replied to the Chaldeans, "The command from me is firm. If you do not make known to me the dream and its interpretation, you will be torn limb from limb, and your houses will be made a rubbish heap. But if you declare the dream and its interpretation, you will receive from me gifts and a reward and great honor. Therefore, declare to me the dream and its interpretation." They answered a second time and said, "Let the king tell the dream to his servants, and we will declare the interpretation." Dream interpretation was a normal part of their world. Oneiromancy was a common method of divination with a long history and established rituals in the ancient Near East. Usually the king would tell the Chaldeans the dream, and they would consult their handbooks and declare its meaning. Sometimes the practice was connected to the occult, where spirits were consulted for the meaning of the dream. At other times, they would use a method known as incubation, especially if they were seeking a dream to foretell the future. Artemidorus, an ancient dream specialist, would sleep in the temples of the ancient gods or goddesses, seeking dreams by which he could foretell the future. Well, this case was different. Nebuchadnezzar refused to give them the dream to interpret. He asked that they tell him the contents of the dream as well as the interpretation. Did Nebuchadnezzar forget the dream? Was he unable to tell the contents of the dream? Or was he testing them to see if they were genuinely able to tell him the future? I think it is the latter situation. The King James Version in verse 5 translates the text as the king answered and said to the Chaldeans, "The thing is gone from me." This would lead us to believe that he had forgotten the dream. But a better translation of the text is found in both the NIV and the New American Standard, where we read, "The king answered and said to the Chaldeans, 'The command from me is firm or certain.'" I believe that Nebuchadnezzar is testing them here. He knows what he dreamed, but he wants to make certain that they are actually able to give him the meaning. He senses that this dream is different and wants supernatural disclosure, not speculative explanations. The only way to find out if they are able to tell the future is to find out if they can tell him the dream. After all, if they can tell him the dream, then their interpretation has greater credibility. I think Nebuchadnezzar is testing them for two reasons. First, the dream he experienced was not a one-time dream. I believe God had sent this dream and that he sensed it was supernatural, which is why it troubled him so much. Second, his reaction makes it clear that he was testing them. Look at verses 8 and 9. The king replied, "I know for certain that you are bargaining for time, inasmuch as you have seen that the command from me is firm, that if you do not make the dream known to me, there is only one decree for you. For you have agreed together to speak lying and corrupt words before me until the situation is changed. Therefore, tell me the dream, that I may know that you can declare to me its interpretation." The situation is dangerous, for the king has imposed a horrible threat on all the wise men in the kingdom. If they could not make the interpretation known, then they were to be torn limb for limb, and your houses will be made a rubbish heap. The text is clear. They were not to be cut up, dismembered, but torn limb for limb. The ancients would bend saplings to the ground and tie them to the limbs of a victim. Then they would cut the tie downs, and the trees would spring into the air with body parts flying everywhere. Well, this was his decree. It's interesting that the Chaldeans eventually respond with a huge admission in verses 10 and 11. They admit that they need revelation to answer the king's question. The Chaldeans answered the king and said, "There's not a man on earth who could declare the matter for the king, inasmuch as no great king or ruler has ever asked anything like this of any magician, conjurer, or Chaldean. Moreover, the thing which the king demands is difficult, and there's no one else who could declare it to the king except gods, whose dwelling place is not with mortal flesh. Revelation is necessary." You see, there are limits to the human mind. Reason can only take you so far, and then you need revelation. Contrary to what many think, reason and revelation are complementary, not antithetical. John Lennox writes, "To say that reason and revelation are antithetic does not even rise to the dignity of being false. It simply doesn't make sense. It is a confusion of categories, as the philosophers say." Daniel needed revelation to know what the dream was, but then he had to use reason to understand God's words. Nebuchadnezzar needed revelation from Daniel, but had to use reason to understand what Daniel was saying to him. John Lennox uses the illustration of Hercule Poirot, the famous fictional investigator who is investigating a crime scene. He asks witnesses questions, but depends upon what they tell him. If they don't speak, he has no information to process. He needs revelation from the witnesses. Once they talk, then he can use, as he puts it, his little gray cells to interpret the revelation and come to some conclusions. Revelation and reason work together in our human experience. The king's advisors virtually admit that they were never able to give him supernatural answers in the past. They may have claimed to consult the gods, but they were not getting any true revelation from any gods. All of their methods failed them. The request was unreasonable and impossible. It goes beyond all human resources, including all religious resources. This admission from his top advisors enrages the king. After all, if he cannot trust them with this challenge, how can he believe anything they say in the future? Now look at verses 12 and 13. "Because of this, the king became indignant and very furious, and gave orders to destroy all the wise men of Babylon. So the decree went forth that the wise men should be slain, and they looked for Daniel and his friends to kill them." One radio talk show host noted that in America we seem immune to the pressures of life, but we are not. We live in a culture filled with broken lives and broken relationships and nowhere to go to find answers. He told about doing a talk show broadcast when singer Kurt Cobain died. A candlelight vigil was held at the International Fountain in Seattle, and many expressed their grief. So he opened up the phone lines on his talk show to discuss the singer and his life. He was amazed at what he found. He was inundated with phone calls. "It's so sad. His songs connected with how I feel. Nobody has touched me so deeply. I feel like I've lost my best friend." Now, these people didn't even know him personally, but his music expressed the torment of their souls so well that they identified with him in his death. There are times when an impossible crisis challenges the limits of our human resources, when people experience life beyond their ability to cope. They are open to God, sometimes for the first time in their lives. Maybe that describes you today. Are you there? I want to invite you, if you are struggling with overwhelming issues and you are not sure where you are spiritually, I want to invite you to put your faith in Jesus Christ. He has the answers that you do not have. And Christian friend, remember that crises are times of great opportunity. listen and be available to people who are going through experiences that challenge the limits of their resources. God has you there by His divine appointment to help them with the soul answers that come from Him. Bill Hybels, former pastor of Willow Creek Church in the Chicago area, told a story that illustrates this readiness. The church published its own magazine and sent the editor and a photographer to Haiti to write a story about a hospital that they were helping financially. Rob Wilkins and Larry Kaiser worked in Haiti for the week, and everything went according to plan until they boarded the plane to return. They were traveling on a 6-passenger chartered airplane when 2 soldiers suddenly jumped the security fence and stormed the plane with explosives and machine guns. They demanded to be flown to Miami since they had been part of a failed coup attempt and were seeking asylum. It was a tense situation, to say the least, as they flew to Miami on that plane. Rob and Larry lived their faith. They began to talk with the 2 men about their families. In time, the men put down their machine guns and drank Cokes with Rob and Larry. And before the flight was over, Rob and Larry had the opportunity to draw a diagram illustrating God's plan of salvation for these 2 soldiers. Rob and Larry were 2 soldiers in God's army who were using God's appointed crises to share how a person could experience God's forgiveness. This leads to the 3rd principle in Daniel 2. The wisdom of God accepts the challenge of the world on faith, verses 14 to 16. Listen to what Daniel writes in chapter 2, verses 14 to 16. Then Daniel replied with discretion and discernment to Arioch, the captain of the king's bodyguard, who had gone forth to slay the wise men of Babylon. He said to Arioch, the king's commander, "For what reason is the decree from the king so urgent?" Then Arioch informed Daniel about the matter. So Daniel went in and requested of the king that he would give him time in order that he might declare the interpretation to the king. Surely the news from Arioch came as a shock to Daniel. He hadn't been a part of this process, and it had to come as a shock. I mean, if someone came to my door and told me I was under arrest and would be executed at the king's command, I'm not sure how calm I would be in the face of that kind of challenge. But if Daniel was shocked, the text does not tell us. He answers with discretion and discernment. The New International Version translates it as wisdom and tact. Daniel does not panic. He does not rage. He does not argue. He simply asks the reason, and Arioch tells him the reason. Apparently, Daniel was included among the list of men who were seen as Chaldeans and so were included in the death penalty. Daniel's response was to seek an alternative. He proposed a solution to the king. He asked for time to declare the answer to him. He accepted the challenge of the king on the basis of his faith in God. His life is on the line. The lives of his friends are on the line. The lives of all the wise men are on the line. Perhaps the king remembered Daniel's skill, or perhaps he was more reasonable by the time Daniel made his request, but the king granted him time to find the answer. Could God have granted the information immediately? Sure, that would be great, but God didn't. God can intervene miraculously, but often he puts our faith to the test as he put Daniel's faith to the test. Notice that Daniel made his request to the king before he had any answer from God. Daniel had to accept the challenge on faith, not knowing when the answer would come. He goes home saying, "Okay, God, this is a great one. I don't know how you're going to do it, but I'm coming to you for the answers. You, God, are the only one who can meet these outrageous demands." The reality is, they would all die unless God revealed the answer. They had nowhere else to go. Ronald Pinkerton describes a near accident that he experienced while hang gliding. He had launched his hang glider and been lifted 4,200 feet in the air. As he was starting his descent, he was suddenly hit by a powerful downdraft. He was trapped in what he called an airborne riptide. As he plummeted toward the ground, he saw a red-tailed hawk about 6 feet off his wingtip, caught in the same predicament. They were now about 300 feet from the ground and still falling. He watched the hawk. Suddenly, the hawk stopped fighting and flew straight downwind. It seemed like a suicidal plan, but the thought entered his mind to follow the hawk. He did. Together, they hit a warm surge of air that carried them both to safety outside the downdraft. He wrote, "I was stunned. Nothing I knew as a pilot could explain this phenomenon. But it was true. I was rising." Sometimes you just have to follow the hawk of God's word. It makes no sense. But you must trust God even when the challenge is unreasonable and beyond your comprehension. Trust him anyway. The wisdom of God accepts the challenge of the world on faith. We may fight, we may struggle, but the way to victory is to follow the wisdom of God and his word. That doesn't mean it will be easy at all. Things may not turn out the way we plan, but we can trust God to take us where he wants us to go. He will reveal his plans in the rest of the book of Daniel, and we will examine the prophecies God makes in this book. They are remarkable prophecies. My friends, a belief in biblical prophecy is at the heart of our Christian faith. The ability to predict the future, as Daniel does, by God's revelation in this book, is supernatural. It is not normal, it is miraculous. For that reason, many do not believe in prophecy and insist that Daniel wrote his book after all these prophecies were fulfilled in history. Skeptics cannot accept the miraculous. Richard Dawkins, the famous atheist, wrote, "The 19th century is the last time when it was possible for an educated person to admit to believing in miracles like the virgin birth without embarrassment. When pressed, many educated Christians today are too loyal to deny the virgin birth and the resurrection, but it embarrasses them because their rational minds know that it is absurd, so they would much rather not be asked." The same attack can be made against biblical prophecy. Christians believe it. We believe it. Non-Christians reject it. As we study Daniel, we will see incredibly detailed prophecies that come true long after Daniel dies. This can only be true because God is the revealer and controller of the future. We can put our faith in him, which is the most reasonable thing we can do. "I take the challenge, Mr. Dawkins. I believe in the virgin birth and the resurrection. And I'm not embarrassed to say it." Just because you can't explain something rationally does not mean it did not happen. In the same way, just because you don't think the future can be predicted doesn't mean that it can't be. The author of the future can predict the future. Remember, the human mind is limited. God's wisdom is not. I would point out one interesting fact before we close our study today. The book of Daniel is one of the few books in the Old Testament that is not entirely written in Hebrew. Beginning in Daniel 2:4 and continuing until chapter 7, verse 28, the text is written in Aramaic. Aramaic was the trade language of the ancient Near East. Why would Daniel write so much of this book in the trade language of the ancient Near East? Well, one reason is that much of this material involves conversations with Gentiles that almost certainly took place in Aramaic. However, many scholars suggest that Daniel may well have composed the first part of this book as an apologetic for the truth of God. He may well have written it to be read by the Babylonians as a testament to what God had done. If this is the case, then Daniel was purposely writing this book, at least chapters 2 through 7 that deal with God's plans for the Gentile world, Daniel was purposely writing this book to communicate to the pagans who did not believe God's word, his revelation. And here is the message that Daniel wants them to know, that Daniel wants us to know. The wisdom of God defeats the mind of man. The wisdom of God defeats the mind of man. Francis Schaeffer put it this way: there are two purposes of Christian apologetics. The first is defense. The second is to communicate Christianity in a way that any given generation can understand. John Stott wrote, "Every Christian should be both conservative and radical, conservative in preserving the faith and radical in applying it." If you are here this morning and the circumstances of your life are out of control, if you are like Daniel, faced with situations that are beyond your ability to fix, then go to God. These kinds of situations are designed to drive us to Him for help. Trust Him to help you find the answers. Someone asked the historian Charles Beard if he could summarize the lessons of history in a brief book. He said that he could do it in four sentences. Number one, whom the gods would destroy, they first make mad with power. Number two, the mills of God grind slowly, but they grind exceedingly small. Number three, the bee fertilizes the flower it robs. And number four, when it is dark enough, you can see the stars. That, my friends, is a pretty good summary of Daniel.